Papers caught on branches wavered and flapped like cut-rate pennants. Here was a silver gleam of summer sun reflected from a clutch of tin cans lying at the bottom of a green entangled hollow. There, the hotter reflection of sun rays bouncing off a broken beer bottle. Beverly spied a baby doll, its plastic skin so brightly pink it looked almost boiled. She picked it up, then dropped it with a little cry as she saw the whitish-gray beetle squirming from beneath its moldy skirt and down its rotting legs. She rubbed her fingers on her jeans. They climbed to the top of the ridge and looked down into the dump. "Oh, shit," Bill said, and jammed his hands into his pockets as the others gathered around him. They were burning the northern end today, but here, at their end, the dump keeper, he was, in fact, Armando Fazio, Mandy to his friends, and the bachelor brother of the Derry Elementary School janitor, was tinkering on the World War II D9 dozer he used to push the crap into piles for burning. His shirt was off, and the big portable radio sitting under the canvas parasol on the dozer's seat was putting out the Red Sox Senators' pregame festivities. "Can't go down there," Ben agreed. Mandy Fazio was not a bad guy, but when he saw kids in the dump, he ran them off at once. Because of the rats, because of the poison he regularly sowed to keep the rat population down, because of the potential for cuts, falls, and burns, but mostly because he believed a dump was no place for children to be. "Ain't you nice?" he would yell at the kids he spied, who had been drawn to the dump with their .22s to plink away at bottles, or rats, or seagulls, or by the exotic fascination of dump picking. You might find a toy that still worked, a chair that could be mended for a clubhouse, or a junk TV with the picture tube still intact. If you threw a rock through one of these, there was a very satisfying explosion. "Ain't you kids nice?" Mandy would bellow. He bellowed not because he was angry, but because he was deaf and wore no hearing aid. "Didn't your folks teach you to be nice? Nice boys and girls don't play in the dump. Go to the park. Go to the library. Go down to community house and play box hockey. Be nice." "Nope," Richie said. "Guess the dump's out." They all sat down for a few moments to watch Mandy work on his dozer, hoping he would give up and go away, but not really believing he would. The presence of the radio suggested Mandy intended to stay all afternoon. It was enough to piss off the Pope, Bill thought. There was really no better place to come with firecrackers than the dump. You could put them under tin cans and then watch the cans fly into the air when the firecrackers went off. Or you could light the fuses and drop them into bottles and then run like hell. The bottles didn't always break, but usually they did. "Wish we had some M-80s, Richie sighed, unaware of how soon one would be chucked at his head. "My mother says people ought to be happy with what they have," Eddie said so solemnly that they all laughed. When the laughter died away, they all looked toward Bill again. Bill thought about it and then said, "I know a place. There's an old gravel pit at the end of the Barrens by the train yards." "Yeah," Stan said, getting to his feet. "I know that place. You're a genius, Bill." "They'll really echo there," Beverly agreed. "Well, let's go," Richie said. The six of them, one shy of the magic number, walked along the brow of the hill which circled the dump. Mandy Fazio glanced up once and saw them silhouetted against the blue sky like Indians out on a raiding party. He thought about hollering at them. The Barrens was no place for kids. And then he turned back to his work instead. At least they weren't in his dump. 7. Mike Hamlin ran past the church school without pausing and pelted straight up Niebold Street toward the Derry train yards. There was a janitor at NCS, but Mr. Gendron was very old and even deafer than Mandy Fazio. Also, he liked to spend most of his summer days asleep in the basement by the summer silent boiler, stretched out in a battered old reclining chair with the Derry News in his lap. Mike would still be pounding on the door and shouting for the old man to let him in when Henry Bowers came up behind him and tore his freaking head off. So Mike just ran, but not blindly. He was trying to pace himself, trying to control his breathing, not yet going all out. Henry, Belch, and Moose Sadler presented no problems. Even relatively fresh, they ran like wounded buffalo. Victor Criss and Peter Gordon, however, were much faster. As Mike passed the house where Bill and Richie had seen the clown, or the werewolf, he snapped a glance back and was alarmed to see that Peter Gordon had almost closed the distance. Peter was grinning cheerfully, a steeplechase grin, a full-out polo grin, a pip-pip-jolly-good-show grin, and Mike thought, I wonder if he'd grin that way if he knew what's going to happen if they catch me. Does he think they're just going to say, "Tag, you're it," and run away? At the train yard gate with its sign, "Private property, keep out, violators will be prosecuted," loomed up. Mike was forced to let himself out to the limit. There was no pain. His breathing was rapid, yet still controlled. But he knew everything was going to start hurting if he had to keep this pace up for long. The gate was standing halfway open. He snapped a second look back and saw that he'd pulled away from Peter again. Victor was perhaps 10 paces behind Peter, the others now 40 or 50 yards back. Even in that quick glance, Mike could see the black anger on Henry's face. He skittered through the opening, whirled, and slammed the gate closed. He heard the click as it latched. A moment later, Peter Gordon slammed into the chain link, and a moment after that, Victor Chris ran up beside him. Peter's smile was gone. A sulky, balked look had replaced it. He grabbed for the latch, but of course there was none. The latch was on the inside. Incredibly, he said, "Come on, kid, open the gate. That's not fair." "What's your idea of fair?" Mike asked, panting. "Five against one?" "Fair up," Peter repeated, as if he had not heard Mike at all. Mike looked at Victor, saw the troubled look in Victor's eyes. He started to speak, but that was when the others pulled up to the gate. "Open up, nigger," Henry bawled. He began to shake the chain link with such ferocity that Peter looked at him, startled. "Open up! Open up right now!"
"I won't," Mike said quietly.
"Open up," Belt shouted. "Open up, you fucking jigaboo!" Mike backed away from the gate, his heart beating heavily in his chest. He couldn't remember ever being quite this scared, quite this upset. They lined their side of the gate, shouting at him, calling him names for nigger he had never dreamed existed. Night Fighter, Ubangi, Spade, Blackberry, Jungle Bunny, others. He was barely aware that Henry was taking something from his pocket, that he had popped a wooden match alight with his thumbnail, and then a round red something came over the fence and he flinched instinctively away as the cherry bomb exploded to his left, kicking up dust. The bang silenced them all for a moment. Mike stared unbelievingly at them through the fence, and they stared back. Peter Gordon looked utterly shocked, and even Belch looked stunned.
"They're scared of him now," Mike thought suddenly,
and a new voice spoke inside of him, perhaps for the first time, a voice that was disturbingly adult.
"They're scared, but that won't stop them. You've got to get away, Mikey, or something's going to happen. Not all of them will want it to happen, maybe. Not Victor, and maybe not Peter Gordon. But it will happen anyway, because Henry will make it happen. So get away. Get away fast."
He backed up another 2 or 3 steps, and then Henry Bowers said,
"I was the one killed your dog, nigger."
Mike froze, feeling as if he had been hit in the belly with a bowling ball. He stared into Henry Bowers' eyes and understood that Henry was telling the simple truth. He had killed Mr. Chips.
That moment of understanding seemed nearly eternal to Mike. Looking into Henry's crazed, sweat-ringed eyes and his rage-blackened face, it seemed to him that he understood a great many things for the first time. And the fact that Henry was far crazier than Mike had ever dreamed was only the least of them.
He realized above all that the world was not kind, and it was more this than the news itself that forced the cry from him.
"You honky chicken shit bastard!"
Henry uttered a shriek of rage and attacked the fence, monkeying his way toward the top with a brute strength that was terrifying. Mike paused a moment longer, wanting to see if that adult voice that had spoken inside had been a true voice. And yes, it had been true. After the slightest hesitation, the others spread out and also began to climb. Mike turned and ran again, sprinting across the train yards, his shadow trailing squat at his feet. The freight which the losers had seen crossing the barrens was long gone now, and there was no sound but Mike's own breathing in his ears and the musical jingle of chain link as Henry and the others climbed the fence. Mike ran across one triple set of tracks, his sneakers kicking back cinders as he ran across the space between. He stumbled crossing the second set of tracks and felt pain flare briefly in his ankle. He got up and ran on again. He heard a thud as Henry jumped down from the top of the fence behind him.
"Here I come for your ass, nigger," Henry bawled.
Mike's reasoning self had decided that the barrens were his only chance now. If he could get down there, he could hide in the tangles of underbrush in the bamboo. Or if things became really desperate, he could climb into one of the drain pipes and wait it out. He could do those things, maybe, but there was a hot spark of fury in his chest that had nothing to do with his reasoning self. He could understand Henry chasing after him when he got the chance. But Mr. Chips? Killing Mr. Chips?
"My dog wasn't a nigger, you cheap shit bastard," Mike thought as he ran,
and the bewildered anger grew. Now he heard another voice, this one of his father's.
I don't want you to make a career out of running away. And what it all comes down to is that you have to be careful where you take your stand. You have to ask yourself if Henry Bowers is worth the trouble. Mike had been running a straight line across the train yards toward the storage Quonsets. Behind them, another chain-link fence divided the train yards from the Barrens. He had been planning to scale that fence and jump over to the other side. Instead, he veered hard right toward the gravel pit. This gravel pit had been used as a coal pit until 1935 or so. It had been a stoking point for the trains which ran through the dairy yards. Then the diesels came, and the electrics. For a number of years after the coal was gone, much of the remainder stolen by people with coal-fired furnaces, a local contractor had dug gravel there, but he went bust in 1955, and since then the pit had been deserted. A spur railroad line still ran in a loop up to the pit and then back toward the switching yards, but the tracks were dull with rust, and ragweed grew up between the rotting ties. These same weeds grew in the pit itself, vying for space with goldenrod and nodding sunflowers. Amid the vegetation, there was still plenty of slag coal, the stuff people had once called clinkers. As Mike ran toward this place, he took his shirt off. He reached the rim of the pit and looked back. Henry was coming across the tracks, his buddies spread out around him. That was okay, maybe. Moving as quickly as he could, using his shirt for a bindle, Mike picked up half a dozen handfuls of hard clinkers. Then he ran back toward the fence, swinging his shirt by the arms. Instead of climbing the fence when he reached it, he turned so his back was against it. He dumped the coal out of his shirt, stooped, and picked up a couple of chunks. Henry didn't see the coal. He only saw that he had the nigger trapped against the fence. He sprinted toward him, yelling, "This is for my dog, you bastard," Mike cried, unaware that he had begun to cry. He threw one of the chunks of coal overhand. It flew in a hard, direct line. It struck Henry's forehead with a loud bonk and then rebounded into the air. Henry stumbled to his knees. His hands went to his head. Blood seeped through his fingers at once, like a magician's surprise. The others skidded to a stop, their faces stamped with identical expressions of disbelief. Henry uttered a high scream of pain and got to his feet again, still holding his head. Mike threw another chunk of coal. Henry ducked. He began to walk toward Mike, and when Mike threw a third chunk of coal, Henry removed one hand from his gashed forehead and batted the chunk of coal almost casually aside. He was grinning. "Oh, you're gonna get such a surprise," he said. "Such a... Oh, my God!" Henry tried to say more, but only inarticulate, gargling noises emerged from his mouth. Mike had pegged another chunk of coal, and this one had struck Henry square in the throat. Henry buckled to his knees again. Peter Gordon gaped. Moose Sadler's brow was furrowed, as if he were trying to figure out a difficult math problem. "What are you guys waiting for?" Henry managed. Blood seeped between his fingers. His voice sounded rusty and foreign. "Get him! Get the little cocksucker!" Mike didn't wait to see if they would obey or not. He dropped his shirt and leaped at the fence. He began to pull himself up toward the top, and then he felt rough hands grab his foot. He looked down and saw Henry Bowers' contorted face, smeared by blood and coal. Mike yanked his foot up. His sneaker came off in Henry's hand. He pistoned his bare foot down into Henry's face and heard something crunch. Henry screamed again and staggered backward, now holding his spouting nose. Another hand, Belch Huggins's, snagged briefly in the cuff of Mike's jeans, but he was able to pull free. He threw one leg over the top of the fence, and then something struck him with blinding force on the side of his face. Warmth trickled down his cheek. Something else struck his hip, his forearm, his upper thigh. They were throwing his own ammunition at him. He hung briefly by his hands and then dropped, rolling over twice. The scrubby ground sloped downward here, and perhaps that saved Mike Hanlon's eyesight or even his life. Henry had approached the fence again and now looped one of his four M80s over the top of the fence. It went off with a terrific crack that echoed and blew a wide bare patch in the grass. Mike, his ears ringing, went head over heels and staggered to his feet. He was now in high grass on the edge of the Barrens. He wiped a hand down his right cheek and it came away bloody. The blood did not particularly worry him. He had not expected to come out of this unscathed. Henry tossed a cherry bomb, but Mike saw this one coming and moved away easily. "Let's get him," Henry roared and began to climb the fence. "Geez, Henry, I don't know." This had gone too far for Peter Gordon, who had never encountered a situation that had turned so suddenly savage. Things were not supposed to get bloody, at least not for your team, when the odds were comfortably slugged in your favor. "You better know.
Henry said, looking back at Peter from halfway up the fence. He hung there like a bloated, poisonous spider in human shape. His baleful eyes stared at Peter. Blood rimmed them on either side. Mike's downward kick had broken his nose, although Henry would not be aware of the fact for some time yet.
You better know, or I'll come after you, you fucking jerk.
The others began to climb the fence, Peter and Victor with some reluctance, Belch and Moose as vacantly eager as before. Mike waited to see no more. He turned and ran into the scrub. Henry bellowed after him,
I'll find you, nigger, I'll find you.
8. The losers had reached the far side of the gravel pit, which was little more than a huge, weedy pockmark in the earth now, 3 years after the last load of gravel had been taken out of it. They were all gathered around Stan, looking appreciatively at his package of black cats, when the first explosion came. Eddie jumped. He was still goofed up over the piranha fish he thought he had seen. He wasn't sure what real piranha fish looked like, but he was pretty sure they didn't look like oversized goldfish with teeth.
Marrow down easy, Eddie-san, Richie said, doing his Chinese coolie voice. It's just other kids shooting off firecrackers.
That sissa sucks the river root, River Richie, Bill remarked.
The others laughed.
I keep trying, Big Bill, Richie said. I feel like if I get good enough someday, I'll earn your love.
He made dainty kissing gestures at the air. Bill shot him the finger. Ben and Eddie stood side by side, grinning.
Oh, I'm so young and you're so old, Stan Urus piped up suddenly, doing an eerily accurate Paul Anka imitation. This, my darling, I've been told.
He can sing,
Richie screeched in his pickaninny voice.
Locks a mussy, this year boy can sing.
And then in the movie tone announcer's voice, want you to sign right here, boy, on this dotted line. Richie slung an arm around Stan's shoulders and favored him with a gigantic gleaming smile. We're going to grow your hair out, boy. Going to give you a guitar. Going to... Bill popped Richie twice on the arm, quickly and lightly. They were all excited at the prospect of shooting off firecrackers.
Open them up, Stan, Beverly said. I've got some matches.
They gathered around again as Stan carefully opened the package of firecrackers. There were exotic Chinese letters on the black label and a sober caution in English that got Richie giggling again.
Do not hold in hand after fuse is lit, this warning read.
Good thing they told me, Richie said. I always used to hold them after I lit them. I thought that's how you got rid of your frock and hangnails.
Working slowly, almost reverently, Stan removed the red cellophane and laid the block of cardboard tubes, blue and red and green, on the palm of his hand. Their fuses had been braided together in a Chinese pigtail.
I'll unwind the...
Stan began, and then there was a much louder explosion. The echo rolled slowly across the barrens. A cloud of gulls rose from the eastern side of the dump, squalling and crying. They all jumped this time. Stan dropped the firecrackers and had to pick them up.
Was that dynamite?
Beverly asked nervously. She was looking at Bill, whose head was up, his eyes wide. She thought he had never looked so handsome. But there was something too alert, too strung up in the attitude of his head. He was like a deer scenting fire in the air.
That was an M-80, I think, Ben said quietly. Last 4th of July, I was in the park, and there were these high school kids that had a couple. They put one of them in a steel trash can. It made a noise like that.
Did it blow a hole in the can haystack? Richie asked.
No, but it bulged out the side. Looked like there was some little guy inside who just stroked at one. They ran away. The big one was closer, Eddie said.
He also glanced at Bill.
Do you guys want to shoot these off or not? Stan asked.
He had unbraided about a dozen of the firecrackers and had put the rest neatly back in the waxed paper for later.
Sure, Richie said. Papa, put them away.
They looked at Bill questioningly, a little scared. It was his abrupt tone more than what he had said.
Papa, put them away,
Bill repeated, his face contorting with the effort he was making to get the words out. Spit flew from his lips.
Sissa, something's gonna happen.
Eddie licked his lips. Richie shoved his glasses up the sweaty slope of his nose with his thumb, and Ben moved closer to Beverly without even thinking about it. Stan opened his mouth to say something, and then there was another smaller explosion, another cherry bomb.
Rocks, Bill said.
What, Bill? Stan asked.
Rocks. Ammo.
Bill began to pick up stones, stuffing them into his pockets until they bulged. The others stared at him as though he had gone crazy. And then Eddie felt sweat break out on his forehead. All of a sudden, he knew what a malaria attack felt like.
He had sensed something like this on the day he and Bill had met Ben. Except Eddie, like the others, was already coming to think of Ben as Haystack. The day Henry Bowers had casually bloodied his nose. But this felt worse. This felt like maybe it was going to be Hiroshima time in the Barrens. Ben started to get rocks, then Richie, moving quickly, not talking now. His glasses slipped all the way off and clicked to the gravelly surface of the ground. He folded them up absently and put them inside his shirt. "Why did you do that, Richie?" Beverly asked. Her voice sounded thin, too taut. "Don't know, Keed," Richie said, and went on picking up rocks. "Beverly, maybe you better go back toward the dump for a while," Ben said. His hands were full of rocks. "Shit on that," she said. "Shit all over that, Ben Hanscom." She bent and began to gather rocks herself. Stan looked at them thoughtfully as they grubbed for rocks like lunatic farmers. Then he began to gather them himself, his lips pressed into a thin and prissy line. Eddie felt the familiar tightening sensation as his throat began to close up to a pinhole. "Not this time, damn it," he thought suddenly. "Not if my friends need me. Like Bev said, shit all over that." He also began to gather rocks. 9. Henry Bowers had gotten too big too fast to be either quick or agile under ordinary circumstances, but these circumstances were not ordinary. He was in a frenzy of pain and rage, and these lent him an ephemeral, unthinking physical genius. Conscious thought was gone. His mind felt the way a late summer grass fire looks as dusk comes on, all rose red and smoke gray. He took after Mike Hanlon like a bull after a red flag. Mike was following a rudimentary path along the side of the big pit, a path which would eventually lead to the dump. But Henry was too far gone to bother with such niceties as paths. He slammed through the bushes and the brambles on a straight line, feeling neither the tiny cuts inflicted by the thorns nor the slaps of limber bushes striking his face, neck, and arms. The only thing that mattered was the nigger's kinky head, drawing closer. Henry had one of the M80s in his right hand and a wooden match in his left. When he caught the nigger, he was going to strike the match, light the fuse, and stuff that ash can right down the front of his pants. Mike knew that Henry was gaining, and the others were close on his heels. He tried to push himself faster. He was badly scared now, keeping panic at bay only by a grim effort of will. He had turned his ankle more seriously crossing the tracks than he had thought at first, and now he was limp skipping along. The crackle and crash of Henry's gopher-broke progress behind him called up unpleasant images of being chased by a killer dog or a rogue bear. The path opened out just ahead, and Mike more fell than ran into the gravel pit. He rolled to the bottom, got to his feet, and was halfway across before he realized that there were kids there, six of them. They were spread out in a straight line, and there was a funny look in their faces. It wasn't until later, when he'd had a chance to sort out his thoughts, that he realized what was so odd about that look. It was as if they had been expecting him. "Help!" Mike managed as he limped toward them. He spoke instinctively to the tall boy with the red hair. "Kids! Big kids!" That was when Henry burst into the gravel pit. He saw the six of them and came to a skidding halt. For a moment his face was marked with uncertainty, and he looked back over his shoulder. He saw his troops, and when Henry looked back at the losers, Mike was now standing beside and slightly behind Bill Denbrough, panting rapidly. He was grinning. "I know you, kid," he said, speaking to Bill. He glanced at Richie. "I know you, too. Where's your glasses, Four Eyes?" And before Richie could reply, Henry saw Ben. "Well, son of a bitch, the Jew and the fat boy are here, too. That your girlfriend, fat boy?" Ben jumped a little, as if goosed. Just then, Peter Gordon pulled up beside Henry. Victor arrived and stood on Henry's other side. Belch and Moose Sadler arrived last. They flanked Peter and Victor, and now the two opposing groups stood facing each other in neat, almost formal lines. Panting heavily as he spoke and still sounding more than a little like a human bull, Henry said, "I got bones to pick with a lot of you, but I can let that go for today. I want that nigger, so you little shits buzz off." "Right," Belch said smartly. "He killed my dog," Mike cried out, his voice shrill and breaking. "He said so." "You come on over here right now," Henry said, "and maybe I won't kill you." Mike trembled but did not move. Speaking softly and clearly, Bill said, "The Barrens are ours. You kids get out of here." Henry's eyes widened. It was as if he'd been slapped unexpectedly.
"Who's going to make me?" he asked. "You, Horsefoot?"
Us, Bill said. "We're through taking your shit, Bowers. Get out."
"You stuttering freak," Henry said. He lowered his head and charged. Bill had a handful of rocks. All of them had a handful except Mike and Beverly, who was only holding one.
Bill began to throw at Henry, not hurrying his throws, but chucking hard and with fair accuracy. The first rock missed. The second struck Henry on the shoulder. If the third had missed, Henry might have closed with Bill and wrestled him to the ground. But it didn't miss. It struck Henry's lowered head. Henry cried out in surprised pain, looked up, and was hit four more times. A little billet doux from Richie Tozier on the chest. One from Eddie that ricocheted off his shoulder blade, one from Stan Uris that struck his shin, and Beverly's one rock, which hit him in the belly. He looked at them unbelievingly, and suddenly the air was full of whizzing missiles. Henry fell back, that same bewildered, pained expression on his face. "Come on, you guys," he shouted. "Help me."
"Charge them," Bill said in a low voice, and not waiting to see if they would or not, he ran forward.
They came with him, firing rocks not only at Henry now, but at all the others. The big boys were grubbing on the ground for ammunition of their own, but before they could gather much, they had been peppered. Peter Gordon screamed as a rock thrown by Ben glanced off his cheekbone and drew blood. He backed up a few steps, paused, threw a hesitant rock or two back, and then fled. He had had enough. Things were not done this way on West Broadway.
Henry grabbed up a handful of rocks in a savage, sweeping gesture. Most of them, fortunately for the losers, were pebbles. He threw one of the larger ones at Beverly and it cut her arm. She cried out. Bellowing, Ben ran for Henry Bowers, who looked around in time to see him coming, but not in time to sidestep. Henry was off balance. Ben was 150, trying for 160. The result was no contest. Henry did not go sprawling, but flying. He landed on his back and skidded. Ben ran toward him again and was only vaguely aware of a warm, blooming pain in his ear as Belch Huggins nailed him with a rock roughly the size of a golf ball. Henry was getting groggily to his knees as Ben reached him and kicked him hard, his sneakered foot connecting solidly with Henry's left hip. Henry rolled over heavily on his back, his eyes blazed up at Ben.
"You ain't supposed to throw rocks at girls," Ben shouted. He could not remember ever in his life feeling so outraged. "You ain't..."
Then he saw a flame in Henry's hand as Henry popped the wooden match alight. He touched it to the thick fuse of the M80, which he then threw at Ben's face. Acting with no thought at all, Ben struck the ash can with the palm of his hand, swinging at it as one would swing a racket at a badminton birdie. The M80 went back down. Henry saw it coming. His eyes widened, and then he rolled away, screaming. The ash can exploded a split second later, blackening the back of Henry's shirt and tearing some of it away. A moment later, Ben was hit by Moose Sadler and driven to his knees. His teeth clicked together over his tongue, drawing blood. He blinked around, dazed. Moose was coming toward him, but before he could reach the place where Ben was kneeling, Bill came up behind him and began pelting the big kid with rocks. Moose wheeled around, bellowing.
"You hit me from behind, Yellow Belly," Moose screamed. "You fucking dirty fighter."
He gathered himself to charge, but Richie joined Bill and also began to fire rocks at Moose. Richie was unimpressed with Moose's rhetoric on the subject of what might or might not constitute Yellow Belly behavior. He had seen the five of them chasing one scared kid, and he didn't think that exactly put them up there with King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. One of Richie's missiles split the skin above Moose's left eyebrow. Moose howled. Eddie and Stan Uris moved up to join Bill and Richie. Beverly moved in with them, her arm bleeding but her eyes wildly alight. Rocks flew. Belch Huggins screamed as one of them clipped his crazy bone. He began to dance lumbersomely, rubbing his elbow. Henry got to his feet, the back of his shirt hanging in rags, the skin beneath almost miraculously unmarked. Before he could turn around, Ben Hanscom bounced a rock off the back of his head and drove him to his knees again. It was Victor Chris who did the most damage to the losers that day, partly because he was a pretty fair fastball pitcher, but mostly, paradoxically, because he was the least emotionally involved. More and more, he didn't want to be here. People could get seriously hurt in rock fights. A kid could get his skull split, a mouthful of broken teeth, could even lose an eye. But since he was in it, he was in it. He intended to dish out some trouble. That coolness had allowed him to take an extra 30 seconds and pick up a handful of good-sized rocks. He threw one at Eddie as the losers reformed their rough skirmish line, and it struck Eddie on the chin.
He fell down, crying, the blood already starting to flow. Ben turned toward him, but Eddie was already getting up again, the blood gruesomely bright against his pallid skin, his eyes slitted. Victor threw at Richie, and the rock fettered off Richie's chest. Richie threw back, but Vic ducked it easily and threw one sidearm at Bill Denbro. Bill snapped his head back, but not quite quickly enough. The rock cut his cheek wide open. Bill turned toward Victor, their eyes locked, and Victor saw something in the stuttering kid's gaze that scared the hell out of him. Absurdly, the words, "I take it back," trembled behind his lips. Except that was nothing you said to a little kid, not if you didn't want your buddies to start ranking you to the dogs and back. Bill started to walk toward Victor now, and Victor began to walk toward Bill. At the same moment, as if by some telepathic signal, they began to throw rocks at each other, still closing the distance. The fighting flagged around them as the others turned to watch. Even Henry turned his head. Victor ducked and bobbed, but Bill made no such effort. Victor's rock slammed him in the chest, the shoulder, the stomach. One clipped by his ear. Apparently unshaken by any of this, Bill threw one rock after another, pegging them with murderous force. The third one struck Victor's knee with a brittle chipping sound, and Victor uttered a stifled groan. He was out of ammunition. Bill had one rock left. It was smooth and white, shot with quartz, roughly the size and shape of a duck's egg. To Victor Chris, it looked very hard. Bill was less than 5 feet away from him.
You could get out of here now, he said, or I'm going to split your head open. I'm a mean it.
Looking into his eyes, Victor saw that he really did. Without another word, he turned and headed back the way Peter Gordon had gone. Belch and Moose Sadler were looking around uncertainly. Blood trickled from the corner of the Sadler boy's mouth, and blood from a scalp wound was sheeting down the side of Belch's face. Henry's mouth worked, but no sound came out. Bill turned toward Henry.
Get out, he said. What if I won't?
Henry was trying to sound tough, but Bill could see a different thing in Henry's eyes. He was scared, and he would go. It should have made Bill feel good, triumphant even, but he only felt tired.
If you won't, Bill said, we're going to move in on you. I think this is a six of us can put you in the hospital.
Seven, Mike Hanlon said and joined them. He had a softball-sized rock in each hand.
Just try me, Bowers. I'd love to.
You fucking nigger!
Henry's voice broke and wavered on the edge of tears. That voice took the last of the fight out of Belch and Moose. They backed away, their remaining rocks dropping from relaxing hands. Belch looked around as if wondering exactly where he might be.
Get out of our place, Beverly said.
Shut up, you cunt, Henry said.
Four rocks flew at once, hitting Henry in four different places. He screamed and scrambled backward over the weed-rattled ground, the tatters of his shirt flapping around him. He looked from the grim, old young faces of the little kids to the frantic ones of Belch and Moose. There was no help there, no help at all. Moose turned away, embarrassed. Henry got to his feet, sobbing and snuffling through his broken nose.
I'll kill you all, he said,
and suddenly ran for the path. A moment later, he was gone.
Go on, Bill said, speaking to Belch. Get out, and don't come down here anymore. The barons are ours.
You're going to wish you didn't cross Henry, kid,
Belch said.
Come on, Moose.
They started away, heads down, not looking back. The seven of them stood in a loose semicircle, all of them bleeding somewhere. The apocalyptic rock fight had lasted less than 4 minutes, but Bill felt as if he had fought his way through all of World War II, both theaters, without so much as a single timeout. The silence was broken by Eddie Kasprach's whooping, whining struggle for air. Ben went toward him, felt the three Twinkies and four ding-dongs he had eaten on his way down to the Barrens begin to struggle and churn in his stomach, and ran past Eddie and into the bushes, where he was sick as privately and quietly as he could be. It was Richie and Bev who went to Eddie. Beverly put an arm around the thin boy's waist while Richie dug his aspirator out of his pocket. Bite on this, Eddie, he said. And Eddie took a hitching, gasping breath as Richie pulled the trigger.
Thanks,
Eddie managed at last. Ben came back out of the bushes, blushing, wiping a hand over his mouth. Beverly went over to him and took both of his hands in hers.
Thanks for sticking up for me, she said.
Ben nodded, looking at his dirty sneakers.
Any time, Keed, he said.
One by one, they turned to look at Mike,
Mike with his dark skin. They looked at him carefully, cautiously, thoughtfully. Mike had felt such curiosity before. There had not been a time in his life when he had not felt it. And he looked back candidly enough. Bill looked from Mike to Richie. Richie met his eyes. And Bill seemed almost to hear the click, some final part fitting neatly into a machine of unknown intent. He felt ice chips scatter up his back. "We're all together now," he thought. And the idea was so strong, so right, that for a moment he thought he might have spoken it aloud. But of course there was no need to speak it aloud. He could see it in Richie's eyes, in Ben's, in Eddie's, in Beverly's, in Stan's. "We're all together now," he thought again. "Oh, God, help us. Now it really starts. Please, God, help us." "What's your name, kid?" Beverly asked. "Mike Hanlon." "You want to shoot off some firecrackers?" Stan asked, and Mike's grin was answer enough.
Chapter 14. The Album. 1. As it turns out, Bill isn't the only one. They all bring booze. Bill has bourbon, Beverly has vodka and a carton of orange juice, Richie a six-pack, Ben Hanscom a bottle of wild turkey. Mike has a six-pack in the little refrigerator in the staff lounge. Eddie Kasprak comes in last, holding a small brown bag. "What you got there, Eddie?" Richie asks. "Xarex or Kool-Aid?" Smiling nervously, Eddie removes first a bottle of gin and then a bottle of prune juice. In the thunderstruck silence which follows, Richie says quietly, "Somebody call for the men in the white coats. Eddie Kasprak's finally gone over the top." "Gin and prune juice happens to be very healthy," Eddie replies defensively. And then they're all laughing wildly, the sound of their mirth echoing and re-echoing in the silent library, rolling up and down the glassed-in hall between the adult library and the children's library. "You go head on," Ben says, wiping his streaming eyes. "You go head on, Eddie. I bet it really moves the mail, too." Smiling, Eddie fills a paper cup 3/4 full of prune juice and then soberly adds 2 capfuls of gin. "Oh, Eddie, I do love you," Beverly says. And Eddie looks up, startled but smiling. She gazes up and down the table. "I love all of you." Bill says, "Well, we love you too, Babev." "Yes," Ben says, "we love you." His eyes widen a little and he laughs. "I think we still all love each other. Do you know how rare that must be?" There's a moment of silence, and Mike is really not surprised to see that Richie is wearing his glasses. "My contacts started to burn, and I had to take them out," Richie says briefly when Mike asks. "Maybe we should get down to business." They all look at Bill then, as they had in the gravel pit, and Mike thinks, "They look at Bill when they need a leader, at Eddie when they need a navigator. Get down to business. What a hell of a phrase that is. Do I tell them that the bodies of the children that were found back then and now weren't sexually molested, not even precisely mutilated, but partially eaten? Do I tell them I've got 7 miners' helmets, the kind with strong electric lights set into the front, stored back at my house, one of them for a guy named Stan Uris, who couldn't make the scene, as we used to say? Or is it maybe enough just to tell them to go home and get a good night's sleep, because it ends tomorrow or tomorrow night for good? Either for it or us." None of those things have to be said, perhaps, and the reason why they don't has already been stated. They still love one another. Things have changed over the last 27 years, but that, miraculously, hasn't. It is, Mike thinks, our only real hope. The only thing that really remains is to finish going through it, to complete the job of catching up, of stapling past to present, so that the strip of experience forms some half-assed kind of wheel. Yes, Mike thinks. That's it. Tonight the job is to make the wheel. Tomorrow we can see if it still turns, the way it did when we drove the big kids out of the gravel pit and out of the barrens. "Have you remembered the rest?" Mike asks Richie. Richie swallows some beer and shakes his head. "I remember you telling us about the bird and about the smoke hole." A grin breaks over Richie's face. "I remembered about that walking over here tonight with Bevy and Ben. What a fucking horror show that was." "Beep, beep, Richie," Beverly says, smiling. "Well, you know," he says, still smiling himself and punching his glasses up on his nose in a gesture that is eerily reminiscent of the old Richie. He winks at Mike. "You and me, right, Mikey?" Mike snorts laughter and nods. "Miss Scarlet, Miss Scarlet,"
Richie shrieks in his pickaninny voice. It's getting a little warm in the smokehouse, Miss Scarlet. Laughing, Bill says, another engineering and architectural triumph by Ben Hanscom. Beverly nods. We were digging out the clubhouse when you brought your father's photograph album to the Barons, Mike.
Oh, Christ, Bill says, sitting suddenly bolt upright. And the pictures.
Richie nods grimly. The same trick as in Georgie's room, only that time we all saw it. Ben says, I remembered what happened to the extra silver dollar. They all turn to look at him. I gave the other three to a friend of mine before I came out here, Ben says quietly, for his kids. I remembered there had been a fourth, but I couldn't remember what happened to it. Now I do. He looks at Bill. We made a silver slug out of it, didn't we? You, me, and Richie? At first, we were going to make a silver bullet. You were pretty sure you could do it, Richie agrees. But in the end, we got cocoa for feet, Bill nods slowly. The memory has fallen naturally into its place, and he hears that same low but distinct click when it happens. We're getting closer, he thinks. We went back to Niebolt Street, Richie says, all of us. You saved my life, Big Bill, Ben says suddenly, and Bill shakes his head. You did, though, Ben persists, and this time Bill doesn't shake his head. He suspects that maybe he had done just that, although he does not yet remember how. And was it him? He thinks maybe Beverly, but that is not there, not yet anyway. Excuse me for a second, Mike says. I've got a six-pack in the back fridge. Have one of mine, Richie says. Hanlon no drink 'em white man's beer, Mike replies. Especially not yours, trash mouth. Beep, beep, Mikey, Richie says solemnly, and Mike goes to get his beer on a warm wave of their laughter. He snaps on the light in the lounge, a tacky little room with seedy chairs, a Silex badly in need of scrubbing, and a bulletin board covered with old notices, wage and hour information, and a few New Yorker cartoons now turning yellow and curling up at the edges. He opens the little refrigerator and feels the shock sink into him, bone deep and ice white. The way February cold sank into you when February was here and it seemed that April never would be. Blue and orange balloons drift out in a flood, dozens of them, a New Year's Eve bouquet of party balloons, and he thinks incoherently in the midst of his fear. All we need is Guy Lombardo tootling away on Auld Lang Syne. They waft past his face and rise toward the lounge ceiling. He's trying to scream, unable to scream, seeing what had been behind the balloons, what it had popped into the refrigerator beside his beer, as if for a late-night snack after his worthless friends have all told their worthless stories and gone back to their rented beds in this hometown that is no longer home. Mike takes a step backward, his hands going to his face, shutting the vision out. He stumbles over one of the chairs, almost falls, and takes his hands away. It is still there. Stan Uris's severed head beside Mike's six-pack of Bud Light. The head not of a man, but of an 11-year-old boy. The mouth is open in a soundless scream, but Mike can see neither teeth nor tongue because the mouth has been stuffed full of feathers. The feathers are a light brown and unspeakably huge. He knows well enough what bird those feathers came from. Oh yes indeed. End of side 18. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.